Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we'll sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these artists. The conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we're having lunch with Greg Donovan. Greg, welcome to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tim.
Sure. Listen, before the show started, we were talking about your Vietnam era.
Yes. I had one. Not in Vietnam, though, thank
you. No, not in Vietnam. No, I was thinking what we should do, all of us who demonstrated in Washington, which I think is probably quite a few people, should get together and we should raise money to build a memorial to that effort to stop that war. Seems like we've got plenty of memorials up there now
It could feature a statue of a Minuteman in a football helmet with a trash can lid and a baseball bat in one hand doing battle with the D.C. police.
Tear gas can in the other hand, right, exactly. Did that experience have anything to do with you becoming a poet? Just that whole, that, you know, the whole late 60s, early 70s?
No, it didn't. And that's interesting that you asked that, because what happened is that I was a great lover of literature from the time I was a kid. It was something that helped a working class kid to escape the environment in which I was being raised. And mm-hmm. When I went to books, I found a world that made sense to me. And
right.
The world I was living in didn't make sense. But one of my essential beliefs about being an artist is that being an artist doesn't relieve you of any responsibility whatsoever to be just an ordinary good Joe and a citizen and everything else.
It doesn't give you the right to just sort of tune in, turn on, and drop out.
No.
And
I didn't feel that way even then. I really felt like social action was very important, that we were living in a time that was clearly dangerous to the health of almost everybody on the planet. Our country was doing terrible things, which it's now continued to do. But and so my making art lived around and in and around all of the anti-war activities and civil rights activities in which I was involved. So what occurred in terms of political activity was that was simply another part of my life, and it rarely became subject matter for art, because so often one's political commitments head you in the direction of propaganda when you mm-hmm. allow it to affect your art. I think that it's better to allow your politics to affect your art in a more essential way. That is,
in a more what?
Essential way.
What do you mean?
It changes your worldview in a more broad sense, so that it's an underpinning, it's a foundation, rather than something that you're constantly foregrounding. Because I think the issues that are very important to write about aren't focused exclusively in the political. And in fact,
what are they focused in?
Human beings.
I mean, this gets at, you know, sort of, you know, so why did you decide to become a poet?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what you're talking about a little bit. I mean,
yeah, I think that
what's in it for you, Greg?
Well, that's,
I mean, besides wealth and fame.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I've become so wealthy. I drive a very old car, which I'm proud of. I think that. Let me come at that another way. When I encourage younger artists to consider the attitudes they need to bring to the making of art, I find myself referring back to what John Keats knew or observed about Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
Shakespeare was, Keats pointed out, myriad-minded. And that meant that he could enter into the consciousness of any number of people, whether it was the kings and nobles or
right.
the groundlings and the poor people. And that myriad-mindedness is a kind of moral and political responsibility that an artist has, I think. Same thing with...
To be empathetic to...
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, that there's nobody really ruled out. I was joking around the other day. My students always hear from me how much I despise George Bush, and mm-hmm. they'll even laugh when I start in on that, and I do try to hold myself back from that.
I'm because, sorry, George who?
You know, that guy that was the son of another president.
Oh, right. And, that George.
It's a dynasty now.
Really?
I think they were thinking about doing another one, but I think we've had
I think
enough.
The girls are going to run for office.
That would be better.
Yeah.
They'd be more entertaining.
They have to serve in the military first, which is a problem because that's not going
to
happen.
They don't seem to want to do it.
No.
And I don't think they'd be very... They'd be a lot like their dad. I think that the responsibility of the artist to enter into a lot of different consciousness... is of different people means that even if you were as a poet or a fiction writer, if you had made the mistake of deciding to take up George Bush as a figure mm-hmm. and write about him, you would have the responsibility to comprehend his humanity, his, you know, bumbling attempts at mm-hmm. believing in himself and caring about the world. And you couldn't just do what you would prefer to do, which is write him off as a dictator jackass. You know?
Right.
Instead, you would have to, if you really did take it up as a subject for your art, unless you betrayed your own abilities as an artist and your mm-hmm. own responsibilities as an artist, you couldn't produce diatribe and propaganda.
So honesty is a big part of this.
I don't think it's even just honesty. It's more perceptiveness, depth of perception. And mm-hmm. and breadth of perception.
So how do you sort your perception, which may or may not be accurate, from, or can you sort your perception from whatever the truth is you're looking for?
Well, I don't think you're, I think that you're not trying to perceive or discover or uncover or reveal a truth so much as you are making a world. And that world that you're making as an artist is a parallel world to the one mm-hmm. we live in. It's one that will allow you to see the world we live in with greater clarity, perhaps. But if you set out to go after the truth, again, you're probably heading towards the direction of narrowing mm-hmm. your range as an artist, mm-hmm. and you're probably going to produce something like propaganda or abstraction of some kind. I think that...
It really is interesting, because in some ways it sounds like a search for God.
There is a religious aspect to it.
In the sense of if you think you know what God is, then you're as far away from it as you can be. If you think you know what truth is, then you're probably as far away from it as you can be.
Yeah, I think it's a lot more interesting when artists propose that they enter into a question and live with it fully mm-hmm. rather than
what
seek
kind of
out.
Question? Can you give me a...
What I think the best way to make art for me, and the mm-hmm. one that I recommend to people who study with me and are looking to become better artists, is actually to look for good material, rich material, that seems to have, for example, in the case of poetry, poetic potential.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an instinct you develop over time, but it has to do with the subject having complexity and richness, and also something about it is really quite challenging.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, your best poems will probably be written about those things that for some reason, aesthetic, political, spiritual, moral, you think, I'm not sure I should be writing about this. That may be the very thing that you will write the best work about mm-hmm. because it is open to your inquiry, and mm-hmm. you write your way into it rather than coming to it with a...
So it's about inquiry.
Yes.
It's about, because, you know, lots of people listening know artists and have experience with that, but a lot don't. So the question is always, well, why would someone want to do this? Why would you want to write a poem, you know? And what you're saying, I mean, we were talking about the creative process as a heading, but sort of the subheading to that underneath that initially is inquiry. Yes?
Yes.
Yeah.
I really think so. Uh-huh. I think that going at it the other way, if you come to the page with a handful of truths in mind that you want to prove or nail down for people, or really what you're in the position of doing is forcing them down people's throats, mm-hmm. you know, nudging them too mm-hmm. hard in the shoulder, saying, I'm superior. I know what you should know, and here's what it is. That will almost always produce inferior art, sometimes radically inferior art.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you come to an experience It might have comical dimensions. It might have tragic dimensions, either one. But you come to, for example, I was reading about Friedrich Nietzsche at one point, reading about his life. I had read a great deal of his writings and had been fascinated by them. And he had astonishing concepts. For instance, the concept of the eternal return, which is posits that given the infinity of past time, if the world was finite, it would already have ended.
Right.
And it's too miraculous that we would suddenly exist in the one moment when there was time.
Time left to exist.
Right. And the rest of all eternity or whatever you want to call it didn't have time and didn't have, you know. So instead, he said, therefore, the world that we live in, the universe, will rise and fall many, many times.
Mm-hmm.
Over the gazillions of eons.
When he says universe, what does he mean? Does he talk about mankind or
Yeah, he's including the whole, but everything.
Everything.
Everything, right. His is not a, a God-centered universe, although you could call it God, that force that drives this renewal happening over and over, and over again. But he suggested that we should all live with the courage and sense of responsibility that every single thing we did, we might one day be doing again, to live as though we were not going to waste any time because we knew we might come back and have to do all this whole same thing all over again, you know, and so and it would look really stupid the second time. You know, some of it would look really dumb. And I enjoyed that. So
I'm going to have to watch a lot of television again.
to really get it. To really get it this time.
Because I'm cursed with this thing where I watch a show and I never forget it. So... Somewhere in the future, there's going to be 35 years of hell waiting for me.
Not so much. As long as you got enough beer and chips, you'll be all right. But when I was reading about Nietzsche's life story, I came across this moment that rang out to me that I would want to write about it. And it was the moment when Nietzsche went incurably insane. For the rest of his life, he never was sane again. And that happened, he was staying in a hotel in Switzerland, I believe it was, and or northern Italy. And he was watching out the window a piazza below his hotel. And in that piazza was an ancient horse who was being forced by the driver to carry a large cart load of something. And the driver was trying to get the last little bit of work out of this horse who was ready for the boneyard.
Right.
And he began whipping the horse's eyes. And Nietzsche ran down of his hotel room, ran out into the street, stopped the man from whipping the horse, and threw his arms around the horse's neck. And from that moment forward was incurably insane. Well, that, just wanting to understand that or enter into that, the drama of that, the intensity of it, the... there's some humor in it. There's the ridiculous, the absurd is in it. And yet there's something also very, I mean, quite humanly touching about it.
Well, the
that.
Horse was Nietzsche, too.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. And so radiating out from that single moment was an opportunity for me to investigate what I was thinking and feeling about Friedrich Nietzsche.
Or about yourself?
It's always about yourself. You never escape yourself. You're so, in fact, that's one of the reasons why I so much encourage my younger students who are just getting started in the art to write not about themselves exclusively, which is what they'd like to do, but to learn how to write about themselves by actually writing often about others. And that's when they realize that their own life is a fiction, and I can prove that to you
scientifically.
Our memories, well, here's the big lecture I give all the time. It's memory versus imagination, friends. Which one is going to win out, you know, in your making of art? Memory is actually not scientific fact like we tend to think. And in fact, it is those very memories of which we would say, that is seared into my memory. It is those very memories which we believe are the clearest ones, which were are the most likely to have been altered by our emotional recasting of the scene over time. For example, I was adopted. and I was adopted at birth. Mm-hmm. I did not find out I was adopted until I was a teenager. Many years later, my mother and I were riding along in the car, the mother who adopted me, who's always been my mother, the mm-hmm. only mother I ever knew. And we were riding along the car, and she said, "Do you remember that day that I told you you were adopted?" And I said, "I'll never forget it. It was seared into my memory." And she said the same thing. And then we proceeded to tell each other completely different stories, different room, different year, different time, different motivation, different everything, every mm-hmm. single thing about the story in my version. And I kept looking at her like, "You have turned into a crazy old lady." And she kept looking at me like, "What in the world is wrong with your mind? You know, you've twisted this all up." We had, over time, each constructed the story around that very powerful moment in both our lives that we needed. We needed that story mm-hmm. to be that way. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, it's a phony question to ask whether which of them was false. Mm-hmm. They were both true. They just didn't agree with. And if a camera had been there to film the whole thing, it would have shown yet another story that mm-hmm. would have agreed with neither of ours, and which we would have had a hard time recognizing by that point.
Do you think the emotion around that changes, though? Do you think you change your emotion?
No. No, and in fact, that's part of what art is about, is using all manner of devices, and they might be unexpected devices, to get you to a place of some kind of psychological, emotional, intellectual honesty. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean just putting the facts down. In fact, it mm-hmm. seldom means that. Because mm-hmm. if that were true, then reading the newspaper every day would give you all the wisdom and insight that you needed to live by, and it just doesn't.
Oh, really? Damn.
Sorry.
I read the newspaper every day.
That's good for you.
It's really sort of self-impressed, but I guess
it's necessary information.
It's necessary,
but also full of lies. You know, its own kind of lies. You know, the hilarious thing.
But that speaks to why art.
Yes.
I mean, what you were just saying.
Yeah, there are
talk about
that
a little more.
Well,
I mean,
for
if
example,
it was just as simple as getting the facts.
Yeah, one of the phrases I often use to students who are learning about the creative process is that they need to allow themselves to learn about the truth of fiction's lies.
The what?
The truth of fiction's lies. That they need to lie to mm-hmm. get at the truth.
Mm-hmm.
If you just... Right. If you spend, like, let's say I want to narrate a story about something that happened a few years ago. I could start the story this way. Mm-hmm. I could say, about 5 years ago, yeah, it must have been 2001. No, it was 2000. I'm sure it was 2000 because it was in April. It was April 1st, about 10 o'clock in the morning. And no, it was 9:58. I can remember because the clocks... By that point, if you aren't bored with this story and want to kill me, there's right. something wrong with you, right? I had a friend who started stories that way. We used to always yell at him, you know, say, "Stop with the damn time and the date. Tell us the story." Right. It shows that facts of that sort, statistical facts or, you know, scientific facts, are they're useful, they're important, but they're not what will take you to the truth of the story, the heart of the story, the revelation mm-hmm. that's going to be in the story.
Well, when I tell stories, I always tell lies.
Yeah, why not?
Because, you know, I mean, I always embellish them.
I think that,
you know,
it's
part of the fun of telling a story.
It makes
you
a good storyteller.
But it makes you a good storyteller, yeah.
Otherwise, I mean, people who don't know that, they tell
like,
really
let me tell you a story.
Stories. Okay.
Yesterday, no, wait a minute. It was 2 days ago.
Don't do that. See, that shows you were right all along. Just start right in on the lies and don't fool around
right.
with anything else.
Don't fool around. Okay. All right. I'll remember that. Art is lies. All right. So moving right along.
It is.
I think that's true.
Art is lies. Art is lies that get at the truth.
That get at the truth. Yeah. That's good. That's good. So why is poetry important? Why should anybody care?
It's made of a material that all of us use all the time, language. And so, in a way, that's probably partly why people have contempt for it. It's kind of like, I think all the arts I've ever been involved with and all of the professions I've been involved with are things that people have contempt for. I used to be a house painter.
Used car salesman? Male prostitute?
I never did those. Thank goodness. Came close.
Came close. A couple of times.
But, you know, the fabric of poetry is language, and its medium of delivery ideally is actually the speaking human voice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite compelling, quite compelling, quite interesting. And there are poems that have given me essential elements by which I understand my own life and how to live. Like Wallace Stevens
really?
Has a poem called The Connoisseur of Chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And I am now, in part, because of that poem, a connoisseur of chaos. If all the green of spring was blue, and it is, if Englishmen lived without tea in Ceylon, and they do, and all of these things, he goes on listing mm-hmm. all of these absurdities that we live with, then we need to understand that any great order is a disorder, and any great disorder is an order.
Mm-hmm.
And any very great order is also a violent order. There's always violence in order.
Mm-hmm.
That poem, that single poem, allowed me to understand a great many things about political history and about my own life that mm-hmm. I've appreciated ever since. In the poetry of William Blake, there are discoveries there that have helped me to live forever. He has these proverbs of hell in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. In that mm-hmm. book, he has these proverbs of hell. And he points out that really angels and devils are both the same thing. We just make one out of the other and mm-hmm. the other out of the other. Back and forth. And one of his proverbs of hell he created, it just goes like this. Enough or too much? Those are the only things you ever want in your life. You want to have just enough, or if you can't have that, then go too far. That's that. But coming up short, not really, no, that is the unacceptable thing.
Yeah. Right.
So if you're going to drink, or if you're going to dance, or if you're going to have sex, enough or too much? But there is no other possible, reasonable, wise choice in that regard. So I'm constantly using that as an aesthetic principle too mm-hmm. with students when they're creating a poem. Either get it just right, have the right amount, the perfectly just enough, not explaining or going into whining or any of those kinds of things. Or if you are going to explain and whine and do everything that you shouldn't do, then go for the wall. Make it perfectly absurd how much whining and explaining and ridiculous, self-justification right. that you do. And then we'll at least be entertained by that, because we'll recognize ourselves in your exaggeration of right. your own whininess.
Whininess. Is this a part of your life? Is this a way of life? Is this a journey for you? How do you see poetry and being an artist?
When I don't allow myself to get distracted, which I frequently do because I have a job mm-hmm. and I edit a magazine, I edit Blackbird, then that's been a very consuming thing lately. It's the job I have and the editing I do, those are related to my making of art,
mm-hmm.
but they're separate activities.
Mm-hmm.
Still, they feed my ability to make art. They inform me. They keep me mentally healthy and alert and, agile. But they are not making art. There is nothing like making art. And making art puts me in a place of deep involvement. The involvement is so deep that there is attached to it a kind of trance-like state that I enter into. So people will often say to me, well, I'm afraid to call your house because do you have certain hours when you make art? And I always tell them that wouldn't bother me in the slightest.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I'm making art, I'm so deeply involved with that, I'm likely to ignore the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I do answer the phone, I'll talk to you. I'll come out of that state, go into normal world mode, and joke and talk.
What does involvement mean? I don't even know if you can talk about that, but
it means that you are making aesthetic choices all the time. You're making language choices. You're trying to make sense of the thing that you're working with. You're also looking for the moments when it might head off into an unexpected direction. You wish to entertain yourself and entertain others, but not in some in the kind of work that I do, not in some cheap way.
Right.
It's the kind of entertainment you get from what Robert Penn Warren called deep delight. And that it's this kind of delight you get when you listen to Mozart or Beethoven, and afterwards you think, well, maybe humanity should be saved from its own extinction. It's possible. You know, you're not sure still, because then there's the Holocaust and a couple other little things like that that maybe, you know, there's the current political situation in the United States that is very depressing, and you wake up and you think, no, maybe this whole operation needs to be burned to the ground. You know? Maybe that's what needs to happen. But I think that art is what has, because of its beautiful uselessness in some ways, but it's uselessness has a utility. That is, you go into your experience of the art object, and whether it's a poem or a painting, they're sister arts, very closely related in terms of selection and composition. You know, a canvas is composed just as a poem is composed. And when you enter into that, and the artist has kept faith with their work and with their vision that they were trying to create, they were making an experience for you is what they were doing. And you have that experience, it leaves you feeling renewed. You feel a sense of awakening, being made more alert,
more alive.
Yes, yeah.
And I mean, do you feel more alive? You said something interesting. I don't want to get too far away from that, but what did you say? Useless? No, you didn't say useless beauty, but something.
Yeah, yeah.
What did you say?
Useless beauty.
Is that what you said?
Yeah,
yeah. Because there's the whole issue of, you know, sort of, well, isn't this just a self-indulgent kind of thing?
Well, I think, you know, all of life is a self-indulgent thing in some sense or another. I mean, you eat, you enjoy what you eat, you breathe, you enjoy breathing, you like to have your heart keep beating. That's very self-indulgent, you know. At that point, who cares? Yeah. No, I think that I don't think that art is at its best when it's trying to serve other purposes, like being propaganda or convince you of a particular political point of view in some narrow way. That is, I believe that good art will take you to good places in your mind and in your spirit, and ultimately that may translate into you being a more decent human being. Yes. But I don't think we need to ask of it that it have some kind of direct, you know, influence and instantly make you a better person when you walk out of the room. Because I believe I am fully conscious of the fact that terrible people can really enjoy art and
make
continue
great art.
Being terrible people.
Yeah, still maybe, make great art.
Yeah, maybe they'll even be better terrible people. You know, after they view, you know,
better terrible
they'll be,
people,
they'll be even better at being terrible. But maybe that's all you can hope for. I mean, art shouldn't be asked to. It is spiritual and religious in that very profound way, not in the way of a Jerry Falwell shaking his finger in your face and telling you exactly what you should do, some narrow moral program. Art doesn't work that way. Art takes you to a place where you are aware of a very large understanding of how the world may be operating. And so it has about it the same sense of power that any religious mystery does. And those can be pondered and turned around in your mind for a lifetime and never exhausted. And that's what great art is like.
We're out of time, if you can believe it. It zooms by. Thank you very much. It was really fascinating. And thank you, folks, for tuning in to Zero Hour. I hope you've enjoyed our lunch together. We look forward to seeing you on the radio next Friday at 12:30. And once again, this is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us.